Cutter Wood's new book, Love and Death in the Sunshine State, The Story of a Crime, is, like Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, a blend of the documentary and the literary. As Wood embeds himself in the investigation of a mysterious murder, he comes to explore not only the circumstances leading up to a woman's death, but the very heart of darkness that can lead love down a nameless path. Again, the name of the book is Love and Death in the Sunshine State, The Story of a Crime, and it's a pleasure to welcome Cutter Wood to the roundtable this morning. Cutter, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What brought you to this particular story?
Yeah, you know, it was kind of the craziest thing. So this all takes place down on Anna Marie Island, which is this very lovely little island off the Gulf Coast of Florida. I was just down there visiting family, and I happened to stay at a motel while I was there. Didn't really think much about it. And then a few months later, after I've left, I got this in the mail from my mother, which just showed this motel in flames. And, you know, the more I learned about this, the more I found myself really kind of sucked into it. Basically, what had happened was this motel owner, a woman named Sabina Musil-Bueller, had disappeared from this island. They'd found someone driving her car, and they were fairly certain that something bad had happened to her, but they didn't really know what. And they had no body, no murder weapon, and they had these three men that they thought were maybe suspects, but really nothing like a motive. So it was just a very confusing case, right? And I go down there to check it out, and I find that this island has just really kind of been turned upside down by this whole thing. You know, I go out to the beach, which is this very beautiful, one of the most popular tourist beaches around. And the detectives are out there with a backhoe. They've got a professor of archaeology and cadaver dogs. And they're just digging an enormous hole, hoping that they luck upon something. And all of these tourists, you know, normally who would be sitting in their beach chairs facing the ocean or going for a swim, have rearranged their chairs so that they're all in a circle around this hole, just looking into it, trying to see what happens. So that was when I realized that there was something serious going on there, you know, a larger story to tell.
When it came to that point of the larger story to tell, what do you know what was driving you to find out the intimate details of this relationship and how ultimately it leads to murder?
Sure. I mean, well, there are a few different things, but I would say one of the biggest was, you know, one of the strange parts of this project was that a lot of this was about this woman, Sabina Musil-Bueller's relationships. She had a husband as well as a boyfriend. And, you know, I as I was learning about her relationships and kind of the struggles that she'd been going through over the past few months before she disappeared, I also had just recently moved in with my own girlfriend for the first time, kind of reflecting Sabina's moving in with her boyfriend, and was going through some very, very similar struggles. You know, so as I'm learning about this relationship just kind of going to pieces, I was reflecting on my own, trying to figure out what I could do to prevent that from happening.
And that, which I guess, you know, it proves obviously to be somewhat easy in the sense that they're not the same motivations, right? So, but you do see yourself in these two, you see yourself and your equation in this scenario.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, I don't think there was ever any danger that something like this was going to happen in my own life. And I'm now quite happily married to my then girlfriend, now wife. But you know, as I was going through this stuff on a day-to-day basis of just the work of cohabitating with a person, I kept thinking back to the interviews that I was conducting in Florida. You know, one of the crazy things that happened as I was going through all these affidavits, one of the suspects in a prior altercation had taken somebody and said to them, "Why do you defy me?" And it just really kind of caught my imagination. It seemed to so perfectly capture that feeling of not having a sense of what's going on in your life and not having a sense of control, that I found myself thinking that all the time in my own life. Why do you defy me? And I'd kind of shake my fist at the sky. So yeah, I did see all of these reflections, even if kind of the narratives were very different.
You wanted to know what it is that makes us have that impulse to hurt someone that we love, destroy someone that we love.
Yeah, exactly. And what kind of, when this whole thing was resolved, this case took about 7 years almost to actually come to a conclusion. And one of the kind of fascinating parts about it all is that by that time I developed enough of a relationship with the man who ended up being found guilty of the crime that I was able to go down there, sit across from him for an entire week, and really get his very detailed story of exactly what happened in the relationship, you know, from meeting this woman, seeing her for the first time, to falling in love, moving in together, to really doing this crime, which was very unspeakable and which he never really thought himself capable of. So that I think kind of provides an interesting window into this sort of thing, which you don't normally get. And also for me, helped me reflect on just what you were talking about, those, what is it that makes us treat those that we love unkindly or with violence.
You also play with this idea of the untrustworthiness of facts in general. Of just, we don't know always what we think we know.
Yes, it's so true. I mean, this whole thing was kind of a study in that for me. One of the, you know, and I found myself as I was investigating it, really caught up more than I'd expected to in that kind of swirl of facts and suspicions. You know, the strangest part of this whole project was at one point in time, while I was working on this, I was teaching at the University of Iowa, teaching creative writing classes. And I got this call while I was in my class from the university police asking me to come down to the station immediately. You know, and I had no idea what was going on. I was thinking maybe I had gotten some parking tickets or something, and I had no idea. I get down there to the station, which is just like a couple of rooms in the mall, you know, beside the Buffalo Wild Wings. And these two university officers take me into the back room and really start grilling me about Sabina Musa-Bueller, who I had was surprised that they even knew about, right? And it took me about 10 minutes of this to realize, you know, they're trying to find out if I have an alibi, and to realize that the police down in Anna Maria, down in Florida, had called them and just said, there's this guy, Cutter Wood, we'd like to talk to him. They hadn't mentioned the fact that they wanted to talk to me because I'd been interviewing one of their suspects. So these university police really thought I was a potential murderer. And so you do easily find the way, like, all of these facts and things become so slippery, and you can get sucked in if you're not careful.
And, I mean, as you relate this, it's also, I mean, obviously you know what the case was, but they're just as sure that they know what the case is.
Exactly. And the strangest, not strange, I mean, there were so many kind of peculiar parts of this, but when I first went down there, everybody had their own personal hypothesis about this case. You know, it's a very small island, it's a very close community, and people really, really kind of developed this, I don't know if psychosis is the right word, but this mass hallucination or something about this case. So it didn't matter who I talked to, they felt very certain about what had happened. And people were even having these strange kind of hallucinations where they thought that they were seeing this missing woman in different places. People thought they saw her at the Salvation Army or at the dentist's office. One woman said that she'd seen her at the airport getting on a flight to Puerto Rico, I think. And another one I spoke with said that she was sure that Sabina was dead, but thought that she would be communicating from the afterlife through her pet parrot. You know, so it's amazing how much everybody's perspective on this kind of hinged upon their own life and dictated what they saw about it.
And doing this and finding out about this story and talking to these people and investigating and questioning the very nature of relationships, and going back to an earlier question, I mean, this has a profound impact on your relationship.
It does. Yeah. You know, it's a funny thing. I never really set out to write about my own relationship or to even consider it in much depth, but the more I wrote about this, the more I felt not just that I had to, that it was kind of one and the same, but also that it was the right thing to do. You know, if I was going to subject these other people's lives to any scrutiny, I felt like I had to do the same to myself. And it was really, for me, a very important thing to have done. You know, you don't often step back and consider in very close and intentional detail what it means to be a good boyfriend, a good husband, a good friend to your partner. So that to me was the most important part of this project, is realizing the things you can do simply to be a better person to those you love.
And the whole idea of this fire too is very, it does become a symbol, doesn't it, of what of what relationships can be, what lives can be.
Yeah, I mean, this fire, which is kind of at the center of this text, you know, the story of it basically is that this woman has disappeared. She's been missing at that point 2 weeks. And, you know, if you're the one who's committed the crime, you would think you've gotten away with it, basically, right? There's no chance she's going to be found after that, almost. And yet whoever did it felt still in such turmoil, so torn up about this whole thing, that they went back to her motel and set it on fire, probably. And that was just so, still baffles me. I still find totally confounding. And yet I think you're right. It is just that. It speaks to everything that's going on in a relationship, how internal it is, how confusing it is, how out of control your own emotions become. So yeah, it's a strange thing, that fire.
Do you find yourself thinking about things in such depth? I mean, is this a one-off, or is this kind of who you are?
Well, good question. Very good question. You know, I think after this project, I've had enough of going and conducting interviews in prisons and jails and that sort of thing, right, and looking into large holes in the sand. But I think this style of investigation, this style of writing is what it's all about. I've always, whether or not I've been reading fiction or poetry or nonfiction, I've always been so fascinated by what's going on in people's brains. You know, I want to know, we do these crazy illogical things all the time. Sometimes they're big things, sometimes they're small. And I just want to know why we do them. I find it to be this endlessly fascinating question. You can just keep pushing and pushing and looking further and further. But I think that will kind of always be what's driving me along.
Well, the book is really fascinating and gripping. The title is Love and Death in the Sunshine State, The Story of a Crime. It is published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Cutter Wood, thank you very much for spending time with us. Very nice to have you on the program.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's been
a pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book is Love and Death in the Sunshine State by Cutter Wood, published by Algonquin Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.